Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far, as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
I was so tempted to say I'm not Melanie Bettinelli and totally mess you up.
Okay.
That would have been funny, but I'm too professional for that.
Totally funny.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I would have laughed. So what's been going on? Let's talk about what we've been doing. We actually went out somewhere. Like, I know last week we went out to the nature center, and this week we went out again.
I know. It's like,
it's like twice. I took a day off of work. I took a personal day, and because I'm the boss and I can do that.
You can take personal days when you want to. Well, sort of.
What it means is I've got to make sure I do work on the day before and the day after that I would have done that day. But, you know, it's just what it is. When you're running things, you can do that, which is one of the reasons I love my job doing this. And anyway, so I took a day and we went to the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston.
You took a day and we went to the MFA. I can't believe you missed that rhyme.
I am not the poet in this family.
Clearly.
I'm the poet and you ought to know it.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, we went to the Museum of Fine Arts on a rainy, windy day. It was really rainy.
It was sort of rainy. It wasn't that rainy.
It was wicked rainy.
No, it was not.
Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. So we drove in. The reason I bring that up is because when you drive in, we have to drive in their big van during rush hour. And that can be when
it's
the weather.
Kind of after rush hour.
Is there really an after rush hour in Boston? There really isn't.
I suppose.
It's a little more rush hour, a little less rush hour.
It feels like after rush hour to me.
Well, the benefit is we can take the HOV lane.
Well, this is true.
Makes all the difference. When I used to have to drive in there alone in my car and watch all those people go into the HOV lane, and I'm stuck in that thick traffic, this bumper to bumper, watching them speed by, I would imagine, maybe I should take a child to work with me.
Take a child to work so you can...
so I can go the HOV lane.
Because then you have to deal with a child all day. I'm not sure that that's...
Give Isabella a book and she can go sit over there and read. She'd be fine. Anyway, we were talking about the MFA.
We were.
This is a welcome to Attention Deficit Podcast. No, we went to the Museum of Fine Arts. No, for no particular reason. Like there's not a special exhibit right now. There's not that we just haven't been in a while. It's our favorite museum in Boston. We have a family membership. We've had a family membership for years now, right?
Yeah.
Like 8-9 years?
Something like that. I don't even know.
It's a fantastic deal. I mean, we've done the math, and we've realized that our best bet is every year to do 2 memberships at a institution. And it's always the Museum of Fine Arts and one other.
Although last year we didn't do a second one.
Well, we finished out the Mystic Seaport one, but didn't pick up a second one at the time. Yeah, we have to. Well, we kind of figure out what we want to do because we've done a lot of the zoos and museums and all that sort of stuff. So it's we need to figure out where we want to go, and so there's no sense getting that second membership until we actually go there and start the clock ticking.
Right.
So we went to the museum. It's their 150th anniversary this year, so there's that sort of celebration going on.
There wasn't anything special up when we were there, though. Really.
Right. They're getting ready for a bunch of exhibits, which is interesting to see, actually, that how much work goes into these.
Right. There were a whole bunch of galleries that were shut, like the special exhibition galleries that were closed. They were putting stuff up. So,
but what that means is we then go to some of the galleries that we haven't spent a lot of the regular exhibits. That we haven't spent a lot of time in.
Right.
That was great.
The normal collection stuff.
Yeah. So where did we start? We started with...
Art of Europe.
Art of Europe. Right. Which was... Was that where we started?
Yeah.
Okay.
No. We started with the jewelry, the Made in Boston jewelry.
Right. That's what
exhibit.
It is. So they have a Boston Arts and Crafts... There was a Boston Arts and Crafts movement. or in like for jewelry, right?
Right. In about the early 1900s, the turn of the century. So like 1910 to 1920, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, they have a little exhibition space that is usually dedicated to jewelry, right next to the musical instruments room,
which we also went to.
Yeah. And so they sort of have rotating jewelry exhibits. And I like that. It's different. It's fun.
It's funny because you're not really a jewelry person. You don't own a bunch of jewelry.
No. I like looking at it. I don't really like wearing jewelry very much. For one thing, I'm allergic to gold.
Right. And other metals,
and other
too.
Things. Like, yeah, metal tends to actually give me rashes. So, but I used to wear a lot more jewelry when I was younger and didn't have kids and could play around with stuff.
You have a few pieces that you wear.
I do.
Now, including that really nice necklace from Kira from Iron Lace Design.
Yes. Anyway, there were some really nice pieces in the jewelry exhibit. And then we bopped into the musical instruments, which is, the kids always love that.
There's some wild instruments from all around the world in there. And some, like, you know, stuff you'd recognize. So there's some harpsichords and pianos. But then there's, like, stuff from everywhere. Like,
every
Asia,
continent.
Africa.
Yeah.
There's fun. Indian stuff, like sitars and... Yeah.
And this time they actually had a really nice little placard talking about how the collection got started. Did you see that?
No.
So evidently there was a family, the daughter was really big into music and the fine arts, and she sadly sailed on the Lusitania and was killed when it was bombed.
Oh, wow.
And so in memoriam for her as a memorial, her family dedicated something like hundreds, like 300, some huge number of musical instruments to the museum.
Oh, wow.
And that was the core of their musical instrument collection, which they've added to over the years. But
that was the beginning.
That was the beginning. I thought it was very sad, but of course it stuck in my head because it was so sad. And I thought, I knew what the Lusitania was.
You know, it's an interesting sociological statement about art museums, which is that, you know, for all that people criticize rich people, art museums generally, and in a lot of art, frankly, would not exist were it not for the patronage of very rich people spending a lot of money on this stuff.
Right.
You know, the buying and then donating or paying artists to make art.
I was actually thinking about that in terms of quilts. We didn't see any quilts today, but there are when we went on Friday, but there is an upcoming quilt exhibition slated for the new year. And we saw a quilt exhibition a few years ago and actually bought the catalog from the museum. And it was that particular one was a specific collection. It was the Pilgrim Roy collection. And so it was two guys who'd collected all of these quilts.
Right.
And so
they were made by generally poor people.
Right. I mean, there were quilts from all over the U.S. and from different time periods and things. And they were beautiful. And you thought, you know, if these people had, you know, if
these quilts would have just sat in moldering in chests or
used on beds and eventually. You know,
because
got
poor
the way
people,
of all fabric.
Right. Well, they were made in not just to be beautiful, but to be functional. But at some point,
a lot of them,
some of them were more artsy. Like you could tell they weren't made to be used regularly. But the point being, but someone saw the art in them and paid for them, bought them, and money went to the artist's family or whoever owned it at the time. And these beautiful works of art got preserved that otherwise wouldn't have been. Like lots of things in the past weren't preserved because they were functional,
right,
and beautiful. Yeah, no.
Yeah, the MFA is a really interesting collection because it has a lot of furniture and fiber arts, clothes, jewelry, things that
paintings and sculptures and
ceramics. And I really like that. In the past, they've had some like interactive exhibits for kids with like touch screens and things talking about like, what is art? And looking at like, here's a really old table and here's a slightly less old table and here's a brand new one. And so sort of going from the obviously beautiful handcrafted art pieces to something that's much more like modernistic today. And which ones of these would you add to your collection? What makes this art and not this art, or are they all art? So I like those questions. The MFA really tends to make me think about what art is and why art is and that sort of stuff.
And they also have, they've been trying to get more into the public, like bringing more people in, a wider range of folk from the city. So it's Black History Month. And so they had a special Black artists exhibition, which was curated by students from public, the Boston Public Schools.
Oh yeah. That was really fun in the Rotunda. And the kids had obviously...
It wasn't student art. It was fine art.
It was fine art that the students had...
That they chose to be part of the exhibit.
And you could tell that the tags for the piece were written by the students. And they had a different tone to them than the tags written by the professional curators. It was interesting to see the students' takes on some of the pieces.
Very didactic in that, you know... Look at this painting. It was a street, like the one of the street scene. You can almost hear the click of the heels on the sidewalk and the children playing. And do you notice you don't see any men? It's just women and children. And, you know, so there's a teaching element to this. And you can tell this is how they've experienced a lot of art. It's someone saying, look at this. And what do you see? And what do you hear when you see it?
Yeah, it was kind of fun to see the art through different eyes than the professional curators.
And I really enjoyed some of those pieces, and so you took some pictures of some of the pencil. Was the pencil drawings ones?
There were a couple. It was mixed media, graphite and ink.
Okay.
There was one. There was a Madonna of Dudley Square, I think.
Madonna of Dudley Square.
So a beautiful Black woman with this very elaborate
African headdress, yeah,
holding a baby, standing on the subway platform with the trains.
Right.
Train tracks behind
elevated
her.
Train.
Yeah. But, elevated train.
Yeah. Then was another of a nursing mother. And that was a really good exhibit. There was a bunch of really nice paintings that were in there. I'm trying to think of what. And then from there, we went to into the European galleries. That's where we went to the European. So there's this big display of porcelain. These giant porcelain sculptures, like from Austria?
I think Austria.
Some crazy rich guy 400 years ago decided they had a giant porcelain factory, and he wanted 600 different giant porcelain sculptures of animals, both real and fictional and fanciful.
It was a porcelain menagerie.
Yeah, it was crazy. Like the entire menagerie itself is crazy. It's just like a crazy rich guy does. They had a bunch of pieces from it. And these are like a 3-4 foot tall, like vulture in detail. And it was all in this central area. And of course, all of our kids know how to behave in museums. No running, no touching, hands behind your back as you look at things. I'm very proud of the fact that they know this now without having us to tell them.
It took a while, but now they know.
And a lot of, you know, heart palpitations in the past. But the reason I say this is there was a guy, an employee, who was changing light bulbs, I guess.
I think he was both changing light bulbs, but also the sensors weren't working that were supposed to warn people when they got too close to the ceramics.
The motion sensors.
And so he was like waving his hands around trying to see like why the sensor wasn't working.
Oh, okay. So he had one of those elevated rolling platform things, like the little truck you stand on it and you elevate it and you move it forward and back, like moving it around this porcelain. I'm like, that guy has much more nerves of steel than I ever would.
No kidding.
I was like, I didn't want to even be near it. I was so nervous for him. It was wild. So that was interesting.
And then later when he was done in that room, he drove it through the gallery, like through the hallway that was lined on both sides with paintings and like sculptures and things. And I'm thinking,
that is
wow.
That takes some guts. I tell you that I wouldn't do it. That gallery is interesting. So there was a lot of porcelain and other stuff, really gaudy. I mean, I'm just, you know, from a from an objective standpoint, very decorative. Really not my style.
I think we would say ornate.
Sorry, ornate. It looks like my Italian grandmother's kitchen. Or no, I'm sorry. It would look like her dining room. Like the pieces are just like very ornate.
You could also say Rococo.
Yes, you could. I didn't. And, one thing I saw that was interesting was they had labeled this. It's a picture of a female saint. And I'm looking at it going, that's Bernini's St. Teresa in Ecstasy.
It was clearly modeled on Bernini's Teresa in Ecstasy.
I'm like, why did this curator not know that? Like,
maybe they just thought it was a
famous piece.
Well, it could also be that they knew it, but they didn't want to overburden the explanation.
Because it's not Bernini who made I would have said modeled on, but whatever. Okay.
Right. It's kind of interesting, like, why curators choose the particular, how they frame things.
Yeah.
And it
frame as in write about things.
Right. Right. How they talk about the stories that they tell, like how you frame a narrative about it. I actually had a roommate when I was in grad school who was taking a museum curator class. Like, she got a certification in museum curation. Mm-hmm. So one of the things they did, they had at the end of their class, they did a practicum where they curated an exhibit. And so they had to do everything like go into the empty gallery space and decide where they were going to put up temporary walls, what colors they were going to paint them, how they were going to arrange the art. They had to make the signage and explanations about the art.
It's not just hanging stuff on the wall.
Right. It's really telling a story with everything in the space, the lighting, the colors that you paint the walls, mm-hmm. how high and low you hang the pictures and what you put where.
How many you put up and what's around them.
Right.
What things do you group together?
And it's fascinating. Ever since she took that class and I sort of got to like pick her brain and listen to it, it's really changed the way I've seen museum shows, because I've started to sort of be more conscious of a person curating. That these things don't just like hang themselves on the wall. They're not just thrown up there any which way. That there's a story and a narrative that they're deliberately telling.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that sometimes more in some galleries than others. Like, for example, when we went to the Monet, they were clearly pairing paintings.
Monet did several paintings of the same subject on different days or different seasons even. And
lighting.
One of my favorite parts of the day was Anthony and Benedict standing in front of these paintings, talking to each other about the differences and getting excited at what they're seeing and explaining to each other and gesticulating at each other and pointing things out and like these little like art mavens. It was really cute and a very proud moment.
And, you know, we've had plenty of museum trips where they were tired and they were bored and they wanted to go home, or they were hungry. And
well, even on this trip, by the time it was ready to go, they were dragging.
And there are definitely some exhibitions, some artists, some works that they're much more excited about than others. My goal is to usually try to get them to at least find one thing, one work that they're interested in, one artist. Even like looking at a painting, find one interesting thing in the painting. You know, mm-hmm. when they were really little, it would be like, can you find the dog in the painting? Can you find a window in the painting? You know, what is the person wearing? That sort of thing. Like, very basic observation questions. And it's fun to see that starting to pay off with much more sophisticated observations.
And you can talk to them about it and you can make it fun. Like, you make up funny stories about what's going on in the painting and kind of open it up, and when it becomes fun, then they become interested. Or, you know, take them to things that they're interested in. Do they like knights and swords and stuff? Take them over to the stuff that you see. That I mean, we're lucky because we've got the MFA, one of the world's great art museums. I mean, it has one of the largest collections of Monet outside of France. I mean, that one room, and in fact, they're having a special Monet exhibit this year that's going to bring all of their stuff, Monets, together, plus more from outside.
Right.
I mean, just how lucky are we to be able to go? And some of these paintings that you would recognize, the listener, like from books or from online or from whatever, and just to stand in front of it. And when we were standing in front of the Van Gogh of the captain, the sailor.
Postman.
Postman. Yeah, it's a postman. I couldn't remember. I was remembering the outfit. But standing in front of this Van Gogh painting and talking about the... the brushstrokes, not just the brushstrokes, but the fact that one corner of the canvas, he really put the paint on thick, and the other corner of the paint, the canvas, you can really see the canvas through the paint. And this isn't something you could do just looking at it in a book or online, you know? And that's one of the reasons why we go to museums, because you can see this amazing stuff up close right there in front of you. The stuff from history. I love that.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So Monet, a bunch of Monet, saw Renoir's, the dancers. That was really nice to see. That was one of my favorite pieces there. I love the European gallery. There's so much good stuff in there. There's Renoir, there's Rubens, there's Degas. I got a nice picture of you imitating Mary Cassatt in Degas' painting
of Mary Cassatt
at the museum
looking at the gallery, looking at art. It's fun.
Yes. So it's a bit meta of a photo,
which was also fun because we had seen that painting in Washington, D.C.,
At the National Gallery
when they had a Degas Cassatt exhibition.
And we had gone on vacation to go visit my mom and my sister down there. And so we popped in.
Yeah. It's kind of fun to see like the same painting in different locations.
Different contexts. Yeah.
It looks very different when it's paired in a different room, paired with different mm-hmm. things.
So what else we saw? There was a room that had all kinds of amber and inlay. I wasn't sure what that gallery was.
Oh, it was a European. I'm blanking.
European sculpture?
It was decorative arts. There was cabinets. There was a table. There was some religious arts. There was like ivories and things carved out of ivory and things carved out of amber. I think it was grouped by time period. I want to say 17th century.
Yeah, there were some really interesting things. There was steins made out of a coconut shell with all covered around with gold and silver and jewels, and one with an ostrich egg in the middle of it.
One of my favorite pieces in that room was the model of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
done with all sorts of beautiful inlays yep. of like mother of pearl and ebony
and the amber
textures.
Rosary, the rosary made out of amber, the huge amber stones. And yeah,
there was also a crucifix that was made completely of amber, which was about 3 feet tall. It was like red and gold amber. It was gorgeous.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. What else did we see? So we went, made our way through there. There was the peasants in the field with the potatoes, in front of the potatoes.
Malay.
Yes, the Malay. And the really great one of the Cyclops and Odysseus.
Yes, the Cyclops throwing the stone, heaving the stone at Odysseus and his sailors as
they tried to sail away.
They're leaving.
Yeah, that was really good. It was fun. Then we had lunch there. They have a really great cafeteria. And afterward, what did we see afterward? We didn't do too much.
That's
more.
When we went to the Impressionists, actually.
Was that after lunch?
That was lunch. I jumped ahead.
Oh, okay. What did we do?
And then we sort of wandered through more European art galleries.
Right.
Yeah, we had some, you know, bathroom breaks, and then the kids got kind of tired.
Take our time. Yeah.
We wandered.
Yes, we did. We wandered through the Asian galleries and the contemporary art galleries.
Yeah, most of the Asian galleries were shut. They were redoing them. I kind of missed. There was one that had Chinese furniture that I really like.
Yeah.
It was closed.
They're preparing for a big exhibit of Byzantine, Greek, and Roman art.
Yeah, that's going to be cool.
Yeah, that's going to, next spring of 2021. So they're doing big work on that.
Oh, I wanted to mention the banners that they had over the cafe.
In the contemporary art wing, yeah.
Those were really cool. So they had commissioned an artist to made three banners of, they were larger than life size portraits of women, and they were both front and back. And on the front, it showed the women in contemporary dress holding contemporary objects. One of them was holding a boombox. Another was holding a jug. And then on the back, it showed the same women holding these mask jugs that were from the museum's collection. And one of them was wearing the Egyptian beaded dress that I love from the Egyptian wing. And it's fun because my friend Kira made
a Japanese chainmail version of that.
A Japanese chainmail dress inspired by the Egyptian dress.
She's an artist who works in form of Japanese chainmail using stainless steel.
And so here was another artist sort of taking the same thing and imagining it on a woman. And so she put her model in this beaded dress with the beaded collar, and it was gorgeous. And another of the women was wearing a shirt that was the textile pattern on it. I don't know if you noticed this. When you're going down to the gallery to the cafeteria, yeah. There's along the hallway there's these plates with textiles from, I want to say, Africa.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're African. Not South Seas Pacific.
Right.
Anyway, there's beautiful black and blue African textiles with these beautiful patterns on them. And her shirt was one of those textile patterns.
Right. So the art of these banners was made based on things that are in the collection. And the front and the back of the banner, I don't know if you noticed that, but like the front of the banner was the woman was holding something having to that was related to, I'm trying to think of what it was. Like on one side, she was holding an African head that gets symbolic head, like mm-hmm. a stone carving. And on the other side, she was holding a modern object that had a similar symbolic or real practical function. So one was like, she's like, on one side, she had a gas can.
Yes.
And on the back side, it had the carved head. And another banner, she had a boombox. And
I said that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what the third one was.
I don't think she was holding something.
She,
the other side.
Yeah. In any case, they were really cool banners. I was looking for the on their website, on the MFA's website. I was looking for the amber stuff, but I found the rosary in amber, which is just really amazing.
Oh, stunning!
We also, the contemporary art had the art by black artists, including the music vase that you liked, the one with the Billie Holiday. You
know. Oh yeah, it was a ginger jar, although I can't imagine having that much ginger because the thing was big enough to hold like
a child.
Right, it was way bigger than a basketball. Like you could put a couple basketballs in it probably, but yeah, it had Miles Davis on one side and Sarah Vaughan and Billie Holiday, and then in between them. There was like musical notes, and then up at the top there was like a piano and a trumpet and various musical instruments, plus also some African animals like an elephant and a camel.
But it was in the style of the Asian ginger jar.
Of a traditional ginger jar. And it was made, I want to say, for like a doctor or a dentist. It was a dentist, I think.
Uh-huh.
It was a commissioned piece. I loved it. It was so fun.
Yeah. And then they had the Ghanaian coffin. In Ghana, they have these elaborate coffins that people get buried in. Like this one was a giant eagle. I mean, this full, like big enough to put a person in. And it was this giant eagle coffin.
It was really cool.
Yeah.
And the description talked about sort of the eagle in traditional Ghanaian art, but also the eagle representing St. John.
Yes, because of the Christianity and
which I thought was really cool.
So we could go on and on and on.
We could.
And so we should probably move on a bit. But yeah, we'll be going back to the MFA again soon. And one of the things that I should mention is Isabella loves to bring her sketchbook. She comes and she sketches, and she's really turning into quite an artist, and which is really nice to see her getting into that.
I usually try to bring my sketchbook and then find that being a mom and hurting children is not as compatible with sitting down and making sketches as I would like. So yes. Isabella, we can kind of leave behind in a gallery while we go on ahead, and then she'll catch up with us.
Yes, except there are two other children who get very distressed when another child is either far ahead or way behind.
Well, yes, but I tell them to hush.
Yes, they're herd dogs. So we made our way home. And the reason I mentioned the weather before was because there was a warning of a big storm, and it was going to be very windy. And lately, wind means we lose power. So before we left, you got the Instant Pot out.
Right. I was planning on soup for dinner, and I didn't have any stock
yeah.
or broth. So I put some bones and some vegetable ends into my Instant Pot with some water and some herbs. And I was thinking, we'll have nice,
fresh, hot stock.
Stock. And I can just throw together soup really quick for dinner. So we got home and all the clocks were blinking and the Instant Pot said off.
Which is bad, because if that broth went off hours ago, not only did it not cook, but it wouldn't be safe anymore. If the temperature dropped too low, it would be all full of germs or possibly germs, and we'd have to throw it out.
Right.
But you opened it up.
I opened it up and it was still steaming.
Yeah.
And so I pulled out my thermometer.
Yeah.
And it said it was 170 degrees.
140 is the key. Once you're over 140, you're in the safe zone. Between 40 and 140 is the danger zone.
Right. And so the Instant Pot, what it's supposed to do is it cooks, and then once it's done cooking, it just holds the temperature above 140. I think it's aims at 145. So if it was at 170, this stock had not cooled down beyond below the danger zone.
It had obviously finished cooking, but it hadn't dropped below. Okay, so that was fine. But the power was on. So the power had gone off.
And then come back on.
Pain in the neck, which means that all my computers and stuff all had turned off in the middle of that. So then you started making dinner.
I started making dinner. I decided to make some biscuits and then make the soup. And so I had the biscuits in the oven and they'd been cooking and I was starting on the soup. I was making chicken lemon soup. So I put some lemon peels in the soup, in the stock. And I was boiling that to get some of the lemon flavor into the soup. It makes it really good. And that's when the power went out again. And this time
it stayed off.
It did not come back on.
Yeah, it was. And when I checked the power company's website, they were giving an estimated time of 9 p.m. This was at 4, close to 5?
It was about 4:30.
4:30. And they were talking about like, oh, it might not, the estimated time is 9 p.m. And they say that estimated time is the time we think that the last customer in your area or affected by your outage will get their power back. So most people will get it back sooner. But we're sitting there going, what do we do? And we've got this pot full of soup, hot soup, and you get these biscuits in the oven, which were mostly done.
The biscuits were like a minute from the timer going off, or 30 seconds. I mean, it was very close when the power went out. And so the oven was still really hot. So I just left them in for another 5 minutes or so to finish browning.
Right.
So they weren't quite done. Our oven tends to take a little bit longer. I finally pulled them out and they looked pretty good.
And so we said, well, we have no guarantee that we'll be able to finish cooking the soup. So we're just going to have to go find some place to eat.
Right. And it was dark because the sun was setting.
Yeah.
So
the house was getting dark. We have, lanterns and candles and stuff, but
cold dinner. The soup was nowhere near being edible.
Right. Right. You hadn't even put the chicken in yet.
No.
Yeah. So this was just broth, lemon flavored broth at this point. So you put the pot in the oven.
Yeah, I had this stroke of genius, which I thought the oven was at 450 degrees for the biscuits. Even though it's off, it's still got a lot of retained heat. It's going to take a while for that to dissipate.
And the soup is in an enamel cast iron pot.
Right.
That's the Dutch oven, which retains heat.
Right. And the soup had been right at a simmer, so it was still hot. So as soon as the biscuits came out, the soup pot went right into the oven.
And the thing, the reason we didn't put this right in the fridge to keep it cold is because with the fridge off and putting hot soup in the fridge,
it's not going to cool it down.
No, you're going to heat up the fridge and ruin everything in the fridge. So this was a last ditch effort to see if we could save the broth.
Right. And I figured I would just pull out the thermometer when we got home. I'd check the temperature of the broth. If it was up above 140, it was safe. If it was below, then we'd throw it out.
Right.
Nothing lost.
Right. Nothing lost except a bunch of bones that we made into broth, so which would be a shame, but wouldn't be the end of the world. So we went out to Chili's in the next town over, which had power because they have better power than we do, because in New England, we haven't learned to bury our power lines so that they don't come down in every storm that blows a little bit. Sorry, that's one of my rantings about around here.
Although I suspect that burying the power lines would be...
Well, it'd be a massive undertaking. Yes, right. I get that. But
also ground shifting with freezing and
thawing. We put lots of things in the ground. There are plenty of pipes and other things in the ground around here that don't get destroyed.
Well...
And there are plenty of power lines in the ground in various places, including in the city. it's just it would be a massive public works effort. And in fact, new neighborhoods don't have power lines. Have you noticed that?
I have not noticed.
So, like, when we were doing the collecting food for the scouting, that new neighborhood down by Brockton, which we were driving around, it's probably built in the last 10, 20 years. There are no power poles. It's all in the ground. That's how you do it all today. But we live in the older neighborhoods. So we're going to have to deal with that for a while. Anyway, we went, got food, came back, power was on, which was nice. And in fact, I found out the power was on when I got the notification from our door lock that it was connected to the internet again. I got that on my phone. That's a nice little feature to know that things are working again. And when you check the soup, it was
hot.
It was actually hotter. It was like 180 or something like that.
Yeah, it had heated up.
So the oven was off. We made sure the oven was off when we left. But yeah, it worked. It stayed hot enough in there to.
So then I just cooled it down, stuck it in the refrigerator overnight, and then we had
soup for soup Saturday night.
Saturday night.
Yeah, which was worked out. And the biscuits, we ate them at breakfast or whatever, because they wouldn't have held. They just, you know, they were already getting a little hard. You know, biscuits don't last like that. That's why you make biscuits. That's why in the old days you made biscuits every night for dinner, you know, or whenever that was, they were going to have biscuits.
I actually toasted mine and they were pretty good.
Yeah, it was good. It was good with a little jam on it. Mm. I had that, the jam from the farmer's market, the lemon orange, was that?
Lemon strawberry marmalade.
Lemon strawberry marmalade. That was really good. So you also made fish cakes, because we'd had fish for dinner the few nights before. We had leftover salmon and haddock.
Yes. Frequently when I have leftover fish, I like to make fish chowder. It's pretty easy, just like potatoes and milk and broth, some
and
onions and carrots things, and things like that. But since we were having the chicken lemon soup, my idea of making chowder, that two soups, just isn't going to cut it.
Right.
I don't only have one soup pot for one thing. So I had the brainstorm of making fish cakes, which I used to make a lot. And because Lucy can't eat them, trying to figure out how to make fish cakes with no eggs and no wheat, I just kind of gave up.
Right.
And so I made sort of salmon haddock fish cakes. And they were really, really good.
And what'd you use for the breadcrumbs?
I just used panko breadcrumbs.
Yeah.
From the can.
That worked out. That worked out pretty good. They were very tasty. I was saying that it wasn't a criticism, just a thought was, hey, if we added some, we had a little aioli with this, it would be really good.
That would have been good. I didn't have time.
It would have had that richness to go along with it. But it's a great way to use up leftover fish of whatever kind.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of threw together, some green onion and celery, finely chopped, and
bell pepper.
No bell pepper. I didn't have any bell pepper. Okay. I threw some Worcestershire sauce and German mustard and an egg, and the panko breadcrumbs. And
like you said, these were not Lucy friendly.
No. They were really yummy though, and some mayonnaise.
Yes.
Make it thick and goopy and stick together.
Do you bake it?
No, I formed them and then I stuck them in the refrigerator for half an hour,
to firm up.
And then I just pan fried them.
Yeah. Worked out really well.
I should have done them in a bigger pan though, because they were a little bit crowded and they kind of crumbled when I tried to flip them.
Ah, yeah. So fish cakes. And then I've been doing, we got a sous vide cooker, a little while ago. I got it as a review unit that I tested out and I got to keep. And so sous vide, or immersion cooker, if you prefer the English word over the French, although immersion is still a French word, what it does is you have a big tub of water and you put this device in and you set it for a temperature and a time, and it raises the water to a particular temperature and holds it there for that period of time. And the theory is you take food, you take something like a pork chop or a steak, and you put it in a bag. And the best thing to do is to put it in a vacuum seal bag so that the water is touching it on all sides, you know, through the plastic.
But without it being waterlogged.
Right. Because you don't want to just drop the food in. That would be bad. But if you put it in a bag and if you vacuum seal it or suck the air out or whatever you want to do it, then you don't have the air as an insulator. Air is a really good insulator, so that would affect the cooking of it. But the idea is you say, I want my, I like my steak at 135 degrees or, you know, to interior temperature. So you stick it in this water and you put it in there for, say, an hour, and you could hold it there. You could hold it there for 2 hours or 3 hours. You know, after a while, it would start to get a little weird texture if you put it in for too long. But you could put, like, meat or other things in there and cook them and hold them at this temperature. And the theory is once it's at that temperature, it's done, essentially. What you don't have is that really good flavor of the sear on the outside. So you take it out, you get a pan, you drop it in the pan, you know, you dry it off, but you drop it in the pan, and it cooks really quick on both sides. One of the problems we have in the non-outside cooking months, when we can't use the grill, because that's New England, there are times when we can't use the grill, is, you know, when we cook inside, we set off the smoke detectors every time, because it's just too smoky to cook meat on the stovetop. But this way, it's already cooked, so it only has to be in the pan for like a couple of minutes, like a minute on one side, then a minute on the other side. And then I try to like cook it, if it's thick, I cook it around the edges, you know, on the edge of the pan. And I did set off the alarm this time, but
you did
when I did the chops, but when I did the steak, I was able to get it done without setting off the alarm. So that was good. But you know, it really comes out, not only is it perfectly cooked, because it's the correct temperature and it doesn't have that gray band. It's, you know, that nice color all over the edge where the sear is, but it's also, I thought it was really tender.
The steaks were incredibly tender.
Yeah.
I was very impressed.
Yes. So really good method. I really like it. We did boiled eggs in it once.
That was not as successful.
I think the Instant Pot boiled eggs is a little easier. It's just, it's less hassle.
Yeah.
But I got to find other things. You can do fish in it. You can do other things like that. So I want to find some other recipes and try them out in the.
Yeah, that's your baby.
It is my thing. It's
not,
it's
definitely not mine.
It's very much an engineering technical sort of thing.
Because what I like about it is then I could say, hey, why don't we sous vide the pork chops? And basically that gets me out of having to cook right. dinner because.
Which is what we do in the summer when you say, how about we grill the pork chops? I'm like, of course, I'm out on the grill.
I usually end up making the side, but.
Yeah.
But it means I only have to deal with the side and not with the main course. I'm sneaky that way.
You are sneaky, but I'm happy to do it because I have fun with it. So that's what we've been eating. Let's talk about what we've been reading or watching. I've been watching. I'm still working on my Revolutionary War book, but I watched three different things I wanted to mention this week. So I watched a Netflix movie that stars Ryan Reynolds, directed by Michael Bay. So, yes.
Michael Bay, that's going to be
lots of things explode.
Classy.
Lots of things explode. Lots of people get shot and lots of snarky commentary. That's Ryan Reynolds. It's called Six Underground. It's about this tech billionaire who has this moment where he realizes there's so much evil in the world and governments are unable to deal with it. So he fakes his own death. This is not a spoiler. It's like in the first 30 seconds you find out this. He fakes his own death and uses his wealth, a little Bruce Wayne style, to create a group of six operatives with different skills who are on a mission to kill the nine most evil men in the world. And incidentally, a lot of their henchmen. It's kind of bloody, kind of a little over the top. I'm not going to recommend it. Frankly, you know, I was bored and it kept recommending it. So I started watching it. But it's the sort of thing I would have watched when I was 20. You know, like there's not a whole lot of story here. There's a lot of shooting, a lot of things blowing up. The fast cars, pretty girls, cool stunts. Snarky commentary. It appealed to a particular 15-year-old leftover remnant in me. So it was what it was. There's not much needs to be said about that. I'm not recommending it, but I watched it. Then there's I finally watched. Got around after having it recommended to me forever. A Quiet Place.
I still haven't seen it, and I don't really want to.
So John Krasinski, Emily Blunt, who are a married couple in real life. I don't know if you knew that.
I did not know that.
He directed it, which was interesting. And in case you're one of the few people who haven't seen it or haven't heard about it, the premise is that at some point in our present time, something happens that a creature emerges of some sort that is completely blind, but hunts by sound, even the slightest sound, and is completely deadly and unstoppable. Okay, there's more than one of these creatures. How many? They don't really get into how it happened or where it came from. Or all we know is we start like in the middle of the story, this family trying to survive under these conditions. And one of the children, so you have mother, father, three kids, one of the children's girl is deaf, which gives them a bit of an advantage because they all know sign language, so they can communicate.
Handy. So if you're going to have the earth attacked, no sign language.
Right. And okay, I get what people are saying. This is a good story about a family, a nuclear family, a functional family. Dad is a good guy. Mom is a good mom. You know, you have kids working together. The whole family is working together. They have their issues that they're dealing with. Oh, by the way, did I mention that the mom is pregnant, going to have a baby? Babies are not known for being quiet. The premise is a little difficult because, like, they have to be absolutely as quiet as, but they walk barefoot everywhere on sand paths that they lay down. Like, the creatures are blind in the sense of they have no eyes, so light is not an issue or anything like that. And at times they're in the same room with it and trying to be quiet. I'm thinking, as quiet as they try to be, like, if this, as good as this thing's hearing is supposed to be, why doesn't it hear them breathing or their heartbeat? So some of the premise gets pushed a little bit.
Right. That's a little bit beyond credulity if they've got super hearing.
Yeah. You've got to have a little bit of suspension of the fact that you suspension of disbelief over the creatures existing in the first place. But so, okay. That said, there was elements of this which were really good. I was really happy. But the whole, like, the movie is very quiet. Like, there's not more than a dozen words spoken in this movie. I mean, there's a few lines. And at one point, I paused the movie, got up to go to the other room, open the fridge to get a snack or something. And our fridge has a door alarm if you leave it open too long. And I'm looking in there. All of a sudden, the thing beeps. I nearly wet myself because I'm like, no, noise. And I'm like, no, it's just a movie. Not real life. Am I glad I watched it? I think so. In fact, I'm going to be doing a podcast on it with Thomas and Herho and Andrew Hermes. We're going to do a Secrets of Movies and TV on A Quiet Place. So I'm glad I watched it. I might actually have to watch it again. But I'm not a fan of horror, and this felt a little bit like horror. It was a little bit like Aliens. Like, it's jump scare horror.
Suspense.
Well, there's a bit of horror too. I mean, they're monsters. They're monsters in the dark, or sometimes not in the dark, but, you know, there are monsters that they're having to avoid. So there's that suspensefulness. Yeah. Not a big fan, but sometimes I'm okay. Like, I liked Aliens, you know.
Aliens is pretty
scary. I liked Aliens better than I liked Alien, funny enough. I was more okay with a group of Marines fighting against a bunch of aliens than I was with one woman and a child being chased through a ship by one alien.
Well, that makes sense, actually, because one woman and one child, the stakes are kind of higher.
Yes.
They're not soldiers. They're
innocents.
Yeah.
And the protective impulse is there, and the just, So I liked Aliens better than Alien. I was more comfortable with Aliens than Alien. It's just funny that way. So that was the other thing I watched. I recommend it. If you can stand the scary elements of it, there are other parts, which I haven't spoiled, that are really make it really worthwhile. Elements of the relationships.
Yeah, I used to watch lots of that stuff, and I probably will at some point again, but not right now.
Well, there's a sequel coming out this March. Like, I'm surprised how quickly they came up with a sequel. I'm going to guess it's not a high production sort of movie to do. So it's kind of interesting. The third thing I watched was the first episode of an HBO documentary I got a chance to look at called McMillions. And this was really cool because it was based on an article I'd read last year that, if you remember, the McDonald's used to do the Monopoly, and I think they still do it, in fact, the Monopoly game.
Yeah, I think they still do.
Where you collect, you know, when you buy a Coke, you know, your meal, you get a little peel-off game pieces on your Coke, your fries, your Big Mac, whatever, and you collect them and you want to get Park Place and Broadway and stuff. And obviously, most of the ones you get are like the, like there's 100,000 of them out there. It's really, there are winning game pieces. So like there's one Broadway, you know, there's 10,000 right. Park Places because they want everyone to be excited. Think, oh, I've already got Park Place. And then there's one Broadway, that sort of thing. Well, it turned out that between 1996 and 2001, almost all, in fact, I think there might even be all of the winners of the big prizes, cars, money, houses, trips, were fraud. They didn't actually win it. Somebody was rigging the game.
How do you rig that game?
Well, I don't necessarily want to spoil it for people, but there was someone on the inside who had access and was basically getting the prizes to people and then getting kickbacks from the people that they were getting the prize to. So I win the $1 million and I give the person who gave me the ticket. And we learn early on that the person at the center of this is known as Uncle Jerry. Uncle Jerry will get some of the money back for it. So, and the stories of the people who participated are very interesting. I mean, not all these people are like, you know, mobsters or criminals, like, oh, I'm in it for the, some people are like regular people who might've been in difficult situations, or they think, oh, look, it's a windfall. I just want to get my piece, you know, to help us out or that sort of thing. So very, it's fascinating. But the first episode, at least, focuses a lot on the FBI agents. And it's really a bit of an unconventional of this sort of true crime documentary. It's kind of done like in an entertaining way, because the FBI agent at the center of this is this kind of wacky guy. It's like he's mm-hmm. very un-FBI like sort of agent. I'm interested to see how it goes. Mark Wahlberg, it's his documentary production company that makes it. He's not in it, but it's Mark Wahlberg okay. is behind it. But it's a fascinating story and fascinating how they caught the guys who did it. So they eventually have to get McDonald's to participate once they figure out that McDonald's wasn't the actual pulling off the fraud, you know, making sure the company, they could talk to the company without alerting whoever was doing it.
So the fraud wasn't happening in the company?
It was happening, without giving too much away, it was happening in a related company, company that was running parts of the game, the promotional game for them.
I see.
I mean, the Monopoly game apparently was huge for McDonald's. When they would run the game, their sales would go up by 40%.
I believe it.
People love the games. They love the idea of winning, but they even just love the idea of, I feel guilty for buying a Big Mac because it's really bad for me, but hey, I'm playing a game and I'm having fun and I might win something. You know, there's that element in it. So they love that. They love the game. I remember as a kid, some of the promotional games, there was like one that was based on video games. I remember that was, I really liked playing as a kid. So, and they've been doing this since 1981. So it's fascinating to see how the game works, but also how they caught the person who did this and how the person came up with this idea. So it'll be fascinating to see this. Hopefully I get to see the other episodes too. But it'll be fascinating to see this. So that's what I've been watching. What have you been, you had two books you wanted to talk about.
Okay.
Lost Words.
Lost Words. And
the Elon Musk book.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Okay.
So these were both books that I've been reading with kids because I'm almost done with my epic reread of the entire Dresden Files series. I just finished the last book and now I'm catching up with the short stories and then I'll be done until the new book comes out in July. So I've been very boring in terms of what I'm reading. I could go on and on about the Dresden Files and how much I love it, but... You probably don't want to hear it. So tonight, for our bedtime story, we read one of my favorite picture books. It's called The Lost Words, and it's a collaboration in sort of the truest sense between a writer and an illustrator. I mean, every picture book kind of is, but in this one, the writer, I believe, maybe the illustrator, had read an article about how dictionaries were taking words out, like children's dictionaries. They only have a certain number of words that they can include. And so there was this trend where they were moving a lot of the words for natural history things. Acorns and herons and ivy.
Dandelion
and heather and conquer. And they were replacing them with words like internet and
log, broadband.
Right. And so this idea of sort of reclaiming or preserving these words that were being dropped from the dictionary. Now, the conceit seems a little bit gimmicky to me. But the book is there's nothing gimmicky about the book. It is gorgeous. It's an oversized folio picture book. So it's really big. And the art is just stunning. And every one of the words has a poem. And the poetry it's really top class poetry. Like, this is not gimmicky kids book poetry. It's beautiful.
It's not doggerel like a lot of kids' books are.
Right.
Yeah.
It's real poetry, and every poem is different. Like, it's not like the same poem with different kind of things added. And I love it. It's a beautiful book, and I love reading it, and the kids do too. Every word has a 3-page spread. There's one which has just got a black and white drawing. That is not of the thing itself, but sort of almost like the space around it. And then has letters. There are a whole bunch of letters scattered across the page. Some of them are gold, and then some of them are another color. And the words that are the other contrasting color spell out the name. So it's kind of a word search. You find the colored letters, and you spell out the word, first of all. So it's literally a spell book, as they say. Mm. And so the kids love to find that. And then you turn the page, and there's the poem. And the poem is one of those, I think they call it an acrostic, where the first line... The first letter of each line, or of each stanza, because sometimes there's multiple lines per stanza, spells out the...
The word.
Yeah. Which sounds like, it sounds like it could lead to really bad poetry, but in this case, like I said, it doesn't. And then beautiful illustration of the thing itself just on a plain gold background. And then the third double page spread is the natural object, animal or plant, in a setting, like with other animals, other plants, like an...
So for example, on Amazon, they have the dandelion pages.
Right.
And they have the dandelion poem, "Dazzle Me, Little Son of the Grass, In Spin Me, Tiny Time Machine, Tick Tock, Sun Clock, Thistle and Dock. Now no longer known as Dandelion, Lion's Tooth, or Windblow, Tick Tock, Sun Clock, Nettle and Dock, Evening Glow, Milk Witch, or Parachute. So let new names take and root, thrive and grow, Tick Tock, Sun Clock, Rattle and Dock. I would make you some, such as Bane of Lawn Perfectionists, or Fallen Star of the Football Pitch, or Scatterseed. But never would I call you only, merely, simply Weed, Tick Tock, Sun Clock, Clover and Dock."
Yeah, I like that one.
Yeah, that's a good one. So it is a nice book, and I prefer kids' books that I have to read to them to be, more interesting and less of that really bad poetry, and the worst ones are the repetitive ones. So I really like this. This one is a good one.
And it doesn't feel repetitive at all. Each poem is very different from the other ones.
Mm-hmm. And then the other book is the one you got from the library, right?
Yeah, this was a library book. And I just, it's this one is actually kind of gimmicky, but I knew it would make the kids laugh, so I grabbed it. It's about Elon Musk.
And the quest for a fantastic future? Is that what it is?
No, it's Elon Musk. This book is about rockets. This is a book about rockets.
Oh, yes. I think I'm looking it up on Amazon. This book is about rockets. Yes.
It's kind of fun because it's got this little gimmick where it talks about something else and then it says, but really this book is about rockets. And so it talks about, it's not, at first it says it's about tacos. No, it's about rockets. And that's going to get a laugh.
Right.
And it talks about Elon loving books and being a bookworm, but this book isn't about books. It's about rockets. And it was about him being bullied in school, but this isn't about being bullied. It's about rockets. And it's about him as a businessman, But it's not really about business. It's about rockets. And I really liked, at the heart of it is the rockets going up and how his, you know, first three rockets all were failures.
The SpaceX rockets.
Right. They go boom. And I like that. It's a nice message for kids about persistence,
right,
perseverance, that, he kept trying even though he failed over and over and over again. And I said, like, I told the kids, like, I would have given up after the first rocket, definitely after the second rocket. I would not have stuck it out for like four rockets exploding.
Right.
But then, and then at the end it comes in with, well, actually, all of these things were important for his development and they were important for making rockets, you know, reading lots of books and being in a, you know, having some business acumen and even, you know, wanting to overcome having been bullied, like to stand up to people and show that, you know, I can do it. So it was a nice little biography book.
Such things could be close to like celebrity worship, that sort of thing. I'm very leery of books about famous people alive today, but yes, this one is not bad. This one doesn't stray too much into that.
Right. I picked it up because I know we've watched videos on
of
YouTube
the rockets, yeah,
of the rockets, and I thought the kids like rockets. I thought they'd be kind of fun.
And he is a bit of a fascinating personality.
I mean, this doesn't go into very much detail. It's a picture book. It's,
right,
you know, 25, 30 pages long, and most of the pages don't have a lot of text on them.
Right, right. We're not getting into his personal life or anything like that.
No, it's really literally a book about rockets.
All right, we're just over an hour, so we should probably start to wrap things up. But I did want to quickly talk about the Catholic topic of Father Michael's homily on Sunday.
Yes.
So the gospel was about, you know, don't hide your light under a bushel basket, which is the whole, you know, we, as Christians, we can't be hiding ourselves. We have to be out in the world. We have to let people see the light of Christ, right, shining from us.
Also about salt. And I really loved the fact Father Michael brought up my favorite thing about salt, which was that salt isn't just about flavor in the ancient world.
Mm-hmm.
It was about preservation, food preservation, and preventing decay and rot.
Right.
And, I sort of made that connection myself when I was reading Mark Kurlansky's book about salt and how important it was as a preservative to prevent rot. And if you think about it, like, that's one of the things that Jesus is saying is when he tells us we are the salt of the earth, we're supposed to prevent corruption.
Right.
To prevent things from
getting bad, from getting sinful,
rancid.
Yeah, rancid.
Spiritually. So I kind of liked that he.
One thing I always wondered, though. But how does salt lose its savor?
You know,
I mean, salt is salt. It doesn't go bad.
I've always wondered about that. And I've never found a satisfactory answer to how does salt lose its savor.
You would throw it out to be trampled. But salt is just a rock.
Like it's just, I mean, is it sort of a factual hypothetical? Like if salt were to lose its flavor, or is this something that actually happened?
I don't know. I feel like there's some anthropological bit of information that we're missing,
right? And I've seen people try to explain it, but I always felt like they were just kind of
guessing.
Yeah, taking a stab at it, but not really.
I wonder if there's something having to do with the way salt was used in the Levant at that time that
missing. I have heard people say. I mean, Mark Kurlansky actually talks about this in his book that if you have a big lump of salt sitting, it will absorb the
absorb flavors and the air
moisture from the air. And it can like start to kind of melt and crumble. And I don't know if that makes it lose its savor, though.
Does it taste less salty or does it? I don't know. Or would it absorb like smells and.
But
taste?
I thought the whole point was of salt that if it preserves things that
it shouldn't be absorbing things. Right. I know. It's weird. I'm going to have to look up something more of that. But the other thing that Father Michael was talking about was the about light in darkness.
I really liked the fact that he started talking about, like, if you're in a dark room and he imagined yourself in a dark room and even the smallest, tiniest glimmer of light changes the entire room. It changes your experience of the room. Suddenly from going with, you can't see anything at all, pitch black, you can see even a little bit of light changes everything all around it. I thought that was really...
And as a metaphor for the light of Christ, even a little bit of the light of Christ changes everything.
Right. So just being present, if we are the light of the world, just our very presence, if we truly have Christ within us, changes everything around us. It enlightens everything, even with us having to specifically go out of our way to do something. Just being Christ changes things. I also liked the point that he made about how light is sort of forever light for everyone, that you can't hoard light.
Right. If you and other people are in a dark room, pitch black, no light, and you light a match, you know, or even a spark, that bit of light lights up everyone, not just you. You can't hide it. You mean you could put it under I suppose you could be under a blanket.
Right. The whole idea of a bushel basket.
Yeah. But
he contrasted it with the idea of private music, like with headphones, you know, kids these days. Everyone's got their own music that they're just have for themselves. You're not sharing it with others. But if you light a light, you can't help but illuminate everything for everyone else.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Which I've found as a practical matter, when you go to bed before I do, and you turn off all the lights, and I like to read before I go to sleep, and I'm trying to read my Kindle in the dark, and you sleepily turn over and whack me with your arm, put out that light.
And unfortunately, I have been afflicted all of my life with an inability to sleep with lights on.
Any light, even the smallest light.
This was very difficult for me in college when I could fall asleep. Usually if my roommate was like up and studying, I could fall asleep with the light on. She'd have like just a dim light over her desk. But inevitably what would happen is I would fall asleep. I'd be asleep for like maybe an hour at most. And then I would wake up and the light would still be on. And I could not get back to sleep as long as the light was on.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be very cranky.
No, that's
very, very cranky. And I would eventually like have to beg my roommate, like tearfully, please, I know you're trying to work on your paper, but I cannot sleep with this light on. Please, can you like go study in the lounge?
Right.
I did not make friends with my roommates. They did not love me for this particular trait.
Yeah. We have gaffer tape over everything that produces the smallest bit of light in our.
Oh yeah, like every little tiny LED on anything has to be covered with tape, because I will wake up in the middle of the night and not be able to get back to sleep because that stupid blinking red LED on the other side of the room.
Those things can be kind of bright. The designers of these things have to realize that. So don't hide your light. Although you were saying you were contrasting that with the light on airplanes.
Right. Father sort of said, you can't hoard light. You can't, you know, keep it to yourself. And I was thinking, well, sometimes if you're trying to read and there's not a whole lot of ambient light, you know, you got the person who's sitting next to you and they've got
on their plane
and their light is shining only on their book. And I've been on a plane where my light was broken. And so the person next to me had a light that, I mean, it was illuminating my space, sure, but it wasn't enough to read by. They were able to read and I wasn't. So
we're not trying to invalidate Father's point, but it is funny
it came to mind.
Yeah. All right. So that's a little thought about the gospel this past Sunday. So take that for what you will. It was nice to share Father Michael's insights, because he's always fun to, he gets these great insights. So before we finish, I do want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including this week, Jordana A., Jason E., Ricky T., Ashley G., and Jacob B. I did not pair Ricky and Ashley to make a Rick Astley joke.
No.
Not at all.
Of course not. Just would never cross your mind.
Anyway, their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. If you had any comments, any feedback you'd like to give us on anything we've talked about, or any suggestions, let us know by commenting at sqpn.com/bets or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to betts@sqpn.com. And we'll have links to the books and other things in our show notes on SQPN. If you can, we would greatly appreciate it, and we really do appreciate those who have done so already. Write a review of the podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast from, and then share the podcast with your friends to help us grow this community of listeners. This isn't a vanity thing. Writing reviews help the algorithms say, hey, we should be showing this to more people because people like it and are writing reviews about it. So every review really does help us a lot. So anyway, until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.